WCCO and Twin City Federal present Minnesota Milestone. The State of Pleasure. The story of sports and recreation. Way back in the dim beginnings, it was decreed that man must work, must sweat and slave to earn his daily bread. And yet wisdom rules that man should not work all the time. Man has the love of laughter and of play, the love of waves gently rippling on a clear morn in summer when the bass strike in their hungry eagerness, the love of blades flashing in the sunlight on the ice-covered lake, the roar of the crowd at the thrill of an 80-yard run, the hunting trip, the county fair, the local celebrations, the crack of a bat meeting a ball and the toppling of the pins for a strike. That is music to men's ears. It is all music, fun time, happy time. WCCO presents the 10th in a series of 12 hour-long special broadcasts in honor of Minnesota's 1958 statehood centennial. This series we call Minnesota Milestones. I'm E.W. Zebarth.
I am Cedric Adams.
I am Halsey Hall.
And I am Bob DeHaven.
We'll tell you a story of deeds. This is the happiest story of them all. Minnesota, the state of pleasure.
Okay, it's right along here. You can cut the motor down now, Cedric.
Looks like a good spot, all right, Bob.
Well, it is a good spot, Halsey. Best bass fishing on the lake.
Ah, but you suppose you're like me and you don't know much about fishing.
Cedric, don't worry about that. Just watch the old master here.
All right, fat boy, I'm watching.
Sit down, DeHaven. You're rocking the boat.
All right, Halsey. Here goes.
DeHaven, you're the old master, all right. That was marvelous. I never saw a healthier-looking batch of seaweed in all my life.
Now, Mr. Hall, I got something on my first cast, didn't I? Let's see what you can do.
Who, me? I'm just resting.
Oh, so am I. I steered the boat, and I'm exhausted.
Glad to meet you, Mr. Exhausted.
Oh, nobody tops that Halsey.
Nobody wants to.
Well, you two go ahead and fish. I'm just going to sit here and take it easy. You know, I wonder how many thousands of guys have fished on this lake.
That's a long story. There were hints back, way, way back, of the great resort industry that was to come in Minnesota. It is on June 29th, 1839, that the editor of the Niles National Register had a most interesting story in his newspaper.
The steamboat Pennsylvania has returned to Pittsburgh following a pleasure excursion to Cincinnati, St. Louis, and the Falls of St. Anthony. The party of 60 ladies and gentlemen arrived at the falls on June 2nd. The steamboat could not go above the Falls of St. Anthony, so the group had quite a novel and romantic excursion of 7 miles over a beautiful prairie in wagons supplied by the politeness and hospitality of the commandant at Fort Snelling. The passengers were much gratified with the trip and gave glowing descriptions of the scenery. We should not be surprised if the attention of our eastern friends should become directed to trips of this kind in preference to loitering in warm weather in the neighboring cities of the Atlantic coast.
Similar trips were made back in the 1830s. Even in those days, Minnesota's fame as a resort area, a playground, was growing. And Southerners came with their slaves from St. Louis and Memphis and Nashville. They came not only in the summer, but also in the winter, especially those suffering bronchial and lung ailments. St. Paul and St. Anthony themselves were the early day resort spots, but these communities could not hold all the visitors, and new resorts were established along the St. Croix at White Bear Lake, Lake Minnetonka. During the 1870s and 1880s, with the coming of the railroads, the tourists pushed even deeper into Minnesota, Land of lakes, an endless supply of beautiful pine-fringed lakes. As a St. Paul editor phrased it,
ye miserable sunburned denizens of the torrid zone, all ye that are roasting and heavy laden, come, and we will give you rest.
Frontenac was known as the Newport of the Northwest back in the 1880s. Hotel registers at Lake Minnetonka carried names of visitors from New York, Missouri, Kansas, and Iowa, in addition to the Deep South.
Among Minnesota's pioneer resort operators, there was J.H. Letson. Way back in the 70s, Letson ran a summer resort on the Excelsior Shore at Lake Minnetonka. He built the Letson Hotel at Alexandria, not far from the St. Paul and Manitoba Railroad tracks. Later, he built the Hotel Alexandria on Geneva Beach at Lake Geneva. The original Hotel Alexandria was destroyed by fire in 1911, but was rebuilt in 1917 and remains one of the oldest Minnesota resorts still in operation. Also claimed to be one of the state's first resorts is Lutzen, near the village of Lutzen, up on the North Shore, some 90 miles northwest of Duluth. A lumberman, Charles A.A. Nelson, had built himself a large home just south of Lutzen. Travelers passing through often stopped there, and the Lutzen Resort property has been expanded and developed under the second and third generations, George Nelson Sr. and George Jr. Lutzen Resort is one of the few that has gone all the way, even has a heated, sheltered swimming pool for wintertime swimming, and enjoys a wintertime business equal almost to that of the summer. That's the modern trend in our Minnesota resorts. Back in the early days, it was mostly the wealthy people, businessmen and their families, who spent their summers in the refreshing coolness of Minnesota. But in the late 1800s and 1900s, there came a change, the streetcar, and the shining rails reached out across the countryside to White Bear and its amusement park, to Stillwater, to Hopkins, and to Lake Minnetonka. And what could be more exciting for any child or even an adult than first a streetcar ride, then a ride on a steamer, then all the thrills of an amusement park, smack in the middle of beautiful Lake Minnetonka. And that was the beginning of a phenomenon we know today as the weekend. Transportation did it then and does it today. It brings Minnetonka, White Bear, Alexandria, Brainerd, the whole state, within easy driving distance of everybody, rich or poor. The luxurious resort or the tent in the woods, now just a few hours away. And Minnesota's resort business has grown until it's the fourth largest industry in the state. Millions each year come to Minnesota, better known than ever before as the state of pleasure.
Hey, I think I got a bite. Feels like a big one.
Probably just some more seaweed. And listen, stop rocking the boat.
Yeah, come on, reel it in. We'll find out in just a minute.
I'm reeling.
While Halsey and Robert tussle with that fish, let's you and I tackle a problem all sportsmen face. How to pay for all the equipment we'd like to own with which to enjoy Minnesota's great outdoors. Boats, motors, hunting and fishing gear, tents, camping equipment, golf gear, ski outfits for the family. All of those things are easy to own if we pay for them in advance, so to speak, with a savings account. Yes, even a family cabin up north is not out of reach if you lengthen your reach with a savings account. And I guess you know the place I recommend. That's right, Twin City Federal, where the saving is safe and where you always earn a generous return. Twin City Federal helps you lengthen your reach, too, with dividends. Consistently liberal dividends. The current rate is 3.5% compounded quarterly. Compounded quarterly means added to your account four times a year. And 3.5% is the top rate in town on insured savings. So if you're kind of wishing for a new duck gun or a new set of golf clubs or a boat, don't stop wishing. Start saving at Twin City Federal, the $300 million savings institution, where the twin clock flashes the time and the temperature. And now let's see what Halsey and DeHaven are up to. I bet they didn't even know I was gone.
You got him, Bobby boy. You got him. He's a beauty, a real beauty.
Hand me that net, will you, Cedric?
Sure, here it is.
Thanks. One quick scooperoo now, and there. Got him. Ha! Now, what do you fellas say?
Well, very good, Mr. DeHaven, very good. A real nice bass, I'd say. What's your guess, about 5 pounds?
Why, of course, a fish this size is bound to weigh 5 pounds.
Yeah. It's funny, though, how many of them lose weight between here and the shore, isn't it?
Well, that was a nasty thing for you to say. Here I got 2 nice bass, and how many have you caught?
Well, don't look at me. I'm not the fisherman in the crowd. I told you that when we started. Besides, you guys think you're pretty smart with 2 bass. Do you know, back in those pioneer days we were talking about a minute ago, a fisherman, a real honest-to-goodness fisherman, would have a boatload by now.
Yes, they did catch fish by the boatload, and game went out of Minnesota by the carload. And that was literally true. Henry Sibley and a party of friends went hunting in 1842, and Sibley himself bragged of the results.
On the 22nd day after our departure from home, we reached our domicile, having in the interval killed 16 buffalo, 3 elk, 8 raccoons, 12 wolves, 7 geese, 244 ducks, and 80 grouse. Besides sundry small game not worth recording.
More hunters came, and more and more, and the guns boomed in the sloughs and the gullies and along the ridges. As far back as 1877, a few sportsmen, a few far-seeing individuals, sensed the end of unlimited supplies of game. Charles Halleck, a famous sportsman of the day and an editor of Forest and Stream, had this bitter lament.
Oh, what a place for game was the land of the Dakotas 20 years ago. It is somewhat different now, in these days when the locomotives of half a dozen railway lines rumble out continually.
And at last, when the modern Department of Conservation was organized in 1931, and the Division of Game and Fish incorporated into it, then and only then was there stern measures to protect what was left of the state's wildlife resources. And the dispute still rages as opposing factions meet. The needs of a growing state with a growing population conflicting with those who would protect the forests, the wild land and its game birds and animals. And in sportsmen's clubs all over the state...
But if they got the meeting started...
All right, let's have it quiet. Now, come on, please, fellas, can we get this meeting started? All right. Now, all right, fellas, quiet.
Then come the minutes of the treasurer's report, a joke about the pancake breakfast that netted $86 because the pancake mix was free. Letters from the Wildlife Federation about wildlife picture stamps. A schoolteacher wants help on Arbor Day. A communication from the Isaac Walton League. The State Conservation Committee meeting coming up in St. Paul. And, of course, the speaker.
We measured about 600 deer, weighed them, studied their teeth, tabulated sex. The findings are conclusive. We are not harvesting as many deer as we could from southern counties. We are losing deer food and cover in our northern forests as the pine and spruce come back. Clearly, another open season is needed to balance off the herd and its range. That's why we have an open deer season this year, in spite of the opinions of some hunters that we are shooting too many deer.
Well, I'm one of those who believe we are shooting too many deer. And I just want to tell you that...
Come on now! Sit down, will you?
All right,
no, he's right! By golly, Mark!
Right.
Even though men do not agree on the methods, the length of seasons, daily bag limits, draining wetlands... Even though a man will occasionally take a pheasant out of season, most of us realize that only strict enforcement of the rules, plus scientific development of outdoor resources, will preserve the fish, the wildlife, for our enjoyment in the years to come. As Minnesota seeks to remain the state of pleasure.
If words were fish, we could all get push carts and go into the fish peddling business.
And what's the matter with that? That's a sign of a good fisherman, you know. He can always talk a lot better than he can fish. Now, let's see here. I have 5. Halsey has 1. 6 fish at 5 pounds apiece, that's 30 pounds of fish.
Look, If those puny little fish you have weigh 30 pounds and I weigh 500.
Halsey, did you hear that? You heard him. He finally admitted it. You're a witness. Cedric weighs 500 pounds.
Yes, and if Cedric weighs 500 pounds, D. Haven, then you weigh 800 and I'm getting out of here because in a couple of minutes the boat won't be big enough for the three of us.
Say, whose side are you on, anyway?
Well, this subject is too weighty for me. Let's do it the way we were before. Three blimps on a barge just having fun.
Just having fun. That's been a part of living in Minnesota for years. And there are lots of different ways to have fun. Minnesotans have gone to work, worked mighty hard to create more recreation. If there is a town in Minnesota without a local celebration, then it's a mighty dead one.
And the lucky young lady.
Who?
The
Who?
Lovely young winner. The Kalachi Queen for 1959, Miss Maureen Hackett.
Oh,
everybody shouts and laughs. The lovely young lady sheds tears, buckets of tears. And everyone agrees, never was there a lovelier queen, never a more successful local celebration. Fun? The history of the Minnesota State Fair sounds like anything but fun, especially back in the early days. The State Fair, it is fair to say, was kicked around from pillar to post, from St. Paul to Minneapolis and back again a dozen times. To Red Wing, to Rochester, to St. Paul, to Minneapolis, to Rochester, to Owatonna. At last, even the tolerant members of the State Agricultural Society grew weary of traveling, and in 1884 they decided the State Fair must travel no longer. The Society listened to many propositions, but the alternatives narrowed down at last to Minneapolis and St. Paul, both fighting for the State Fair tooth and nail. Both fighting as hard as they were to battle for Major League Baseball rights in a more recent day. Minneapolis made its bid.
Gentlemen, we are prepared to offer you the choicest possible location. A location most ideally suited to the lofty ideals and purposes of our state fair. Gentlemen, for a reasonable consideration, of course, we are offering you the tract of land adjacent to Minnehaha Falls.
It appeared that the Minneapolis offer would be accepted at one stage in the negotiations, but then, in a secret maneuver, the St. Paul delegation presented the clincher.
Now, this is just an exploratory discussion, you understand, but I am reliably informed that should the Society see fit to locate the State Fair permanently in St. Paul, my informants say, they will donate to the Society, free of all encumbrances, the present property occupied by the Ramsey County Poor Farm.
The offer was accepted without hesitation. The State Fair, dedicated to bringing farm and city people closer together, so both may see and understand the work, the industry, the skills of the other. The Minnesota State Fair has had its banner years and its lean years. But many a man and woman still alive remembers with a thrill and a lump in the throat one of the peak years. The year 1906.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dan Patch has paced the mile out in 1 minute 55 seconds flat, breaking the world record!
And the multitude broke out in a frenzy of excitement, roaring with delight. Hats were hurled recklessly into the air, their wearers giving no thought to their recovery. Women waved handkerchiefs. Men and women hugged one another, jumped up and down, clapped one another on the back. The Minnesota State Fairgrounds became a bedlam. The crowd spilled over onto the track. And Dan Patch, scarcely breathing hard, was petted and pampered and praised on that glorious afternoon. Dan Patch had won many a race before. He won many a race again. But it was in his home state, on a Saturday afternoon in 1906 that Dan Patch turned in the greatest performance in racing history. His record has never been surpassed to this day. Dan Patch, the unbeatable. And today, wherever men gather, at the county fairs, at the big city raceways, the men in silks still talk of the greatest pacing horse of them all, the great Dan Patch. The Minnesota State Fair has enjoyed a degree of success undreamed of when it was established in St. Paul. It grew from a six-day agricultural exposition to an eight-day fair, and in 1939, the present 10-day fair became a permanent fixture. And in the year just past, the fair has had its most successful year, an attendance of 1,200,000, ground and buildings worth $25 million, operating at a profit. A recreational feature of which Minnesota can well be proud, its state fair.
We wish to correct the wrong impressions too generally held that St. Paul and Minnesota are Hyperborean region where existence is a burden during the winter months. We also wish to demonstrate to the hordes of tourists and pleasure seekers that the winter atmosphere of Minnesota is so dry, so pure, so clear, so bright, that it is a privilege to live in it.
And so, on the 1st of February, 1886, the first St. Paul Winter Carnival was held. And that first carnival was an immediate success. Thousands of persons came from all over the United States, many from Canada. The center of activity was the Glittering Ice Palace, erected those years in Central Park near the state capitol. Near it were skating and curling rinks and toboggan slides. There were snowshoeing and skiing, horse racing on the frozen Mississippi River, theater-going fancy dress balls and concerts. The Winter Carnival became a casualty, however, in the 1890s, when the depressions hit hard and left people in little mood for gaiety. But it was revived, enlarged, and modernized. The legend of King Boreas was written by Frank Madden and made a permanent part of the now successful, widely enjoyed St. Paul Winter Carnival.
It was a good many years before Minneapolis was able to stage a local celebration as successfully as St. Paul had. But one rainy, dark day in the summer of 1939, a Minneapolis Chamber of Commerce delegation had traveled to Winnipeg to take part in ceremonies welcoming the King and Queen of Britain. Sitting in the rain-soaked bleachers were the late Dave Onan, restaurant man Tom Hastings, and publicity man Mike Fidel. And Fidel turned to the others.
If we only had this crowd in Minneapolis.
Why, we could get a lot more people if we had a natural attraction like this.
Look, Dave, why don't we put on a big show in Minneapolis? A show like the St. Paul Winter Carnival, only in the summertime.
And back in Minneapolis, the process of organizing was begun. Minneapolis sportsman Alfred D. Lindley drew up the legal papers. Hastings was elected president. Henry Baker, vice president. Pat Carr, secretary. The name came from two Greek words, aqua meaning water, and tennio meaning annual, aquatennial. An estimated 1 million persons take part in one or more of the aquatennial events each July, with 500,000 witnessing the big parade on the opening Saturday. The sponsoring businessmen of both the St. Paul Winter Carnival and the Minneapolis Aquatennial have come to know their efforts are not solely responsible for attracting hundreds of thousands of persons each year. People also come because of Minnesota's famous lakes and hills and beaches and resorts, a land of fun and enjoyment, truly the state of pleasure.
You're listening to the State of Pleasure on Minnesota Milestones. The program will continue in just a moment from your Centennial Station in St. Paul and Minneapolis, WCCO. This centennial year marks an important milestone in the growth of my favorite savings institution, Twin City Federal. Just recently, Twin City Federal resources topped the $300 million mark. $300 million worth of homes and happiness, savings and security for thousands and thousands of folks throughout our entire Northwest. Yes, $300 million. Well, that's a lot of money in anybody's language. Looms even larger in the language of thrift. Few things are so fundamental to individual, family, and community happiness as money saved. In the language of confidence, $300 million is a mighty resounding vote for Twin City Federal. Twin City Federal is the largest in savings of all federals in the United States. It's our Northwest's leading home financing institution, too. Since everybody wants a home and everybody needs a savings account, Twin City Federal hopes to have the pleasure of serving you sometime very soon. For home loan help or saving help, look for the twin clock that flashes the time and the temperature in downtown St. Paul or Minneapolis. The $300 million savings institution, Twin City Federal. Plenty of free parking for you right at the door, too.
Tough luck, Bob. I'd have sworn you had that one hooked, and he looked to me like a big one.
Well, why is it that the biggest ones are always the ones that get away, you know?
Did it ever occur to you maybe that's the reason they're the biggest ones?
Well, tell me something. The big lie is not confined to fishing alone, is it? Haven't there been some tall ones about other sports?
Oh, yes, I guess there's been plenty of exaggeration along the way, but just remember this. When you start talking about spectator sports, bear in mind that often the truth, the plain unvarnished truth, is more amazing than the lie. And one of the amazing truths, believe it or not, is that there was a spectator sport here in Minnesota when our pioneer forefathers arrived. The Indians played a game the white man knew as lacrosse. This was a game the white man never understood too well. It was played over miles and miles of ground, in clearings, through forests, and across streams. Guess you might say it was a combination of tennis without a net, cross-country running, and a little mayhem thrown in to make it lively. The pioneers, though, were not so carefree about their spectator sports. Minnesota had the period of blue laws back in pioneer days, lasting until the early 1900s. Horse racing was considered immoral because of the betting that went with it.
Swimming at Como Park during the hours of daylight is hereby declared illegal. Bathers shall be guilty of a misdemeanor should they swim at the aforesaid beach after the hour of sunrise or before the onset of darkness.
All boxing was illegal. And so matches were held either just across the line in Wisconsin or in defiance of the law in Minnesota for years. Only when the Minnesota Athletic Commission was established in 1915 did prize fighting become legal. And baseball was not exempt either. Nearly every community in the state had a law on the books which made Sunday baseball illegal. Baseball was the earliest organized sport in Minnesota. By the 1880s, organized baseball had spread to the western part of Minnesota. One league included teams from Glencoe, Arlington, Litchfield, and Hutchinson. And in this league, there originated one of the great sagas of Minnesota baseball, the pair of games between Dassel and Hutchinson back in 1887. In those days, ringers or professionals were commonly used in amateur sports. And when Dassel played Hutchinson, it brought two players from a professional team in Minneapolis, the Lindale Stars, and won a smashing victory. Embittered Hutchinson vowed revenge and laid plans well. It was on a warm summer afternoon, and Sam Minton, the proprietor of the Merchants Hotel at Hutchinson, received a telegram at Dassel where he had gone to watch the baseball rivalry between the two towns.
Mr. Minton?
Yes?
The depot agent told me to bring this telegram to you.
Oh, yes, thank you. Here you are, boy.
Thank you.
Hey, boys, this is it. Uh-oh. Just listen to this.
The baby is worse.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Come home at once. You know what to do now.
We'll get that vessel bunch of surprise. Just leave it to us.
You bet your boots. Just
and so the men from Hutchinson bet every cent they had on their team to win that afternoon. And since Dassel already had won the first game of the series, they found plenty of takers. And the message, the baby is worse, come home at once, that meant that Hutchinson had been successful. They had contacted umpire Jack Bennett and poured out their woes to him. And the enterprising Bennett obtained two players, a pitcher and a catcher from a Minneapolis professional team, Peekaboo Veach and Maya Murray. And when the game ended that afternoon, Hutchinson was the winner 9-6, and Hutchinson had evened the score with Dassel. The tricksters had been out-tricked. The Minton baby was not worse. It wasn't even ill. In fact, the Mintons did not have a baby. Minneapolis had played an important part in organized baseball since 1882. That was the year Minneapolis became one of the original teams in the old Western League. Nicollet Park was completed in 1896, supplanting that old park back of the West Hotel at 5th Street and 1st Avenue North, and the Millers, under the leadership of outfielder manager Walter Wilmot, celebrated the move to the new park by winning the pennant. In 1906, the Millers were well on their way to another pennant when there came an incident that wrecked their plans and nearly ruined professional baseball in Minneapolis. It was the middle of July, and the Millers were in the lead, one game ahead of Columbus, when Columbus came to town for a crucial series at Nicollet Park. League president Joseph O'Brien had assigned a young rookie umpire to officiate. Minneapolis lost the first two games of the series, and the fans felt the decisions made by the umpire, Brick Owens, were to blame. On the third day of the series, the stands were packed, the game had not yet begun. Owens turned to the stands.
The batteries for today!
The irate fans pelted the field, and Owens, with overripe fruit and even riper eggs they had brought along for the purpose. And Owens was even more irate. Above the roar of the crowd, he shouted to be heard.
Forfeit! Hereby proclaim the winners of the Columbus!
And that did it. The angry fans boiled onto the playing field. Police wielded their clubs in desperation, but the surging throng outnumbered overwhelmed the desperate police. Pushing, shoving, fighting, clawing, seeking only to get their hands on the hated umpire to tear him to pieces. And then, in the nick of time, a gigantic figure of a man fought his way through the crowd, bowling over men who stood in his way as though they were children. The giant, the greatest guard in football history, well-known, beloved sports figure, Pudge Heffelfinger. Heffelfinger wrapped his arms around umpire Owens.
You are about to do something that will forever disgrace the good name of Minneapolis. An act you will always regret. All right. Now, I am going to escort this man off the field, and I'm taking him to his hotel. And I warn you, anyone who harms him must answer to me.
And the protesting roar of the crowd died to a grumble. Outside, a police patrol wagon was waiting, and Heffelfinger and Owens were hustled downtown. Owens went on to become an outstanding umpire, working in both major leagues. And in spite of all the handicaps that year, Mike Kelly piloted the Millers to third place behind Columbus and Milwaukee. Of course, there were no playoffs in those days, and when they started in 1933... the Millers put together one of the most awful playoff records you can imagine. In 9 or 10 playoffs, they were eliminated in the first round. They never won a series. And then 1955, when they won 8 straight from Omaha and Denver and beat Rochester 4-3 in the Junior World Series. And of course, as if to celebrate Minnesota's splendid centennial, they took 4 games from Wichita out of 6, 4 straight from Denver, and made only the 3rd sweep in Junior World Series history by winning 4 in a row from Montreal.
Look, Hall, you mean to tell me all those baseball stories are the truth?
Yes, sir, Cedric, my boy. Every word. All of it really happened just like that and right here in Minnesota.
That's amazing. No wonder fishermen tell such whoppers. They have to top stories like those.
And that isn't all. Boxing has produced its share of colorful stories, too, hasn't it, Halsey?
And that is absolutely true. Few people around here remember that some of the all-time greats in boxing fought right in the Twin Cities. Bob Fitzsimmons, Tommy Ryan, Charlie Mitchell, Ike Weir, and even old John L. Sullivan himself.
Sullivan fought here? Where?
Well, it was in a roller skating rink on Washington Avenue North between 6th and 7th Avenues, and the year was 1887. Sullivan came for a title bout against Patsy Cardiff. And then back in 1891, Minneapolis was the scene of one of the longest fights ever fought under the Marquis of Queensberry rules. And the battlers, Tommy Ryan of Chicago, the world welterweight champion, and Danny Needham of St. Paul. And Needham gave Ryan a terrific battle until Ryan finally won on a knockout in the 76th round. When boxing became legal in Minnesota in 1915, and from then until 1925... no city outside of New York boasted more top-flight boxers than did St. Paul. The gyms were full of them. There were Mike and Tommy Gibbons, Mike O'Dowd, Billy Miskey, Jack Malone, Johnny Ertel, and Jimmy Delaney, all the cream of the crop. And then, of course, the Golden Gloves claimed some share of national glory from Minnesota. Jackie Graves of Austin, winning many years ago in the Tournament of Champions at Chicago, and Jimmy Jackson of Minneapolis capturing the same title in 1957.
What's that on the end of your line, Cedric? A football?
That's not my line, Bob. You must be referring to Halsey.
Oh, sorry. What's your line?
Well, it goes something like this. All kidding aside, I've found, like most folks, that you get more fun out of life if you build your pleasure on a solid foundation of security. Also, like a lot of other folks, I've found that a Twin City Federal Savings account is the solid center of a good security program. Money you save at Twin City Federal is money you can depend on for the future as long as there is a future. Money saved at Twin City Federal is insured for safety, insured by a permanent agency of Uncle Sam's government. And don't forget, Twin City Federal welcomes your account whether you start large or small. They know. They watch people build thousands of dollars of good security money out of a $5 start simply by saving regularly. Why not stop in if you haven't already done so? Why not build for a brighter future through thrift? With a $300 million savings institution. Twin City Federal is the name. Twin City Federal. Conveniently located in downtown Minneapolis and St. Paul, where the twin clock flashes the time and the temperature, and where there's ample free parking for you right at the door.
You were talking a while ago, Cedric, about the fisherman and his tall tales. Don't know what you think about it, but maybe the golfer can measure up to the angler when it comes to telling the big fibs.
Say, what have you been doing, Hall? Looking at some of my scorecards?
No, I haven't. But I guess that puts both of us in the same league.
I don't count the times I miss the ball, but I never cheat.
Well, I'll tell you something. Everybody loves a fat man, and everybody expects him to cheat at golf.
It wasn't until the 1890s that golf began to take hold in Minnesota, and the first golf club was Town and Country in St. Paul. Not in St. Paul in those days, of course, but way out in the country. The Minnetonka Club of Minneapolis was organized as a golf club back in 1898. The Country Club at Duluth opened in 1899. By 1937, there were in the Twin Cities area 31 public and private golf courses.
Mr. Willie Kidd Sr. came to Interlochen Golf Club in the year 1920 and retired only last year, 1957. Now, many people know, but maybe you youngsters don't know, that Interlochen Golf Club in July of 1930 was the scene of a memorable golf tournament, the 1930 National Open. It is here that the famous Georgian Bobby Jones completed the Grand Slam of golf, and the only Grand Slam in the history of golf. Jones already had won the British Open and the British Amateur and the United States Amateur, and he came to Interlaken trying to win the fourth major title in the world. Could he do it? Well, he got into trouble on the ninth hole. The ninth hole over the water provides a scene of the golf shot that never will cease to be a topic of conversation. Willie Kidd, what happened to Bobby Jones at hole number nine?
Well, number nine, he had a wonderful tee shot. A little to the left of center, which really put him in an excellent position for the green. Standing up at his ball, he was a little bit above it. So that when he hit, he didn't really get all the ball. He only half topped it. So it looked very much as if he was going to finish up in the drink. The ball instead hit right on the top of a lily pad and started to skip. And skip right across the lake up onto the fairway. Where he was able to stand up there, pitch it up, pull it out for a birdie instead of perhaps a nice little bogey.
A sensational performance on the part of Bobby Jones. He won the Grand Slam of golf, the four major tournaments in the United States. Thanks, Willie Kidd, for telling us about this. And in 1930, truly Minnesota was a state of pleasure for the great Bobby Jones.
Bowling had its humble beginnings in Minnesota back in the early 1900s. It was played in poorly lighted and badly ventilated establishments, usually in basements, and some of those rat-infested. But over the years, bowling has moved upstairs into ultra-modern buildings with brightly lighted interiors and automatic pin setters. Today, there are well over 100 bowling alleys in the Twin Cities area alone.
It was back in the roaring 20s that Minneapolis sports fans encountered a thrill they have never experienced since. The sport was ice hockey. And for one season, 1925 and 26, Minneapolis had a hockey squad that had few, if any, equals. The coach was Lloyd Turner, and his star players were the fabulous Ching Johnson and his brother Ade, plus the sensational goaltender Tiny Thompson. This team steamrollered all opposition and swept through the Central Amateur Hockey League competition to the title. But almost before the team clinched the title, there in the spring of 1926, the raiding began. Ching and three other stars went to the Rangers, and the Boston Bruins lured away the rest of the team. And after that, Minneapolis fans lost interest in hockey. In the 1930s, interest in hockey was revived for a time. There were professional teams in both Minneapolis and St. Paul. Those were the years of the Hansons. Five brothers, Julius, Louis, Joe, Emil, and Oscar, wrote a lasting chapter in hockey at Augsburg College in Minneapolis. The five Hansons won national fame for Augsburg. They were coached by Nick Kaler, better known as a sports promoter in later years. In the 1950s, University of Minnesota hockey has again revived spectator interest in the sport, thanks to a bitter rivalry between the Gophers and the University of North Dakota. But professional, big-time hockey, hit in the Great Raid of 1926, has never again aroused the interest of the paying public.
And then came the greatest rags-to-riches sports story of them all, the Minneapolis Lakers. It began in 1947 when two Minneapolis showmen, Ben Berger and Morris Chalfin, and restaurateur Max Winter acquired the Detroit Gems for $15,000. All they had was a pile of dirty uniforms and a franchise in the National League. The Lakers' first title came on April 16, 1948. And that was the start of the Lakers' victory string, an unbeatable combination. Schaefer and Slater Martin at guards, Pollard and Farron, Arnie Farron, the Bobby Soxer's idol at forwards, and Big George Mikan, Mr. Basketball himself, at center.
No thrill could ever match that of being named Mr. Basketball the first half century back in 1950. To be accorded the same honor in basketball Babe Ruth received in baseball was something that will always stand out in my memory over any playing experience.
And then, of course, there were many great high school moments in various state tournaments. Moorhead with Moran and Homrast, Buell, Red Wing, Thief River Falls, Bemidji, Patrick Henry and Jim McIntyre, those great Hopkins clubs, and Roosevelt of recent memory. some of the standouts, I couldn't possibly name them all. And this is the basketball tournament which truly makes Minnesota a state of pleasure for the high school kids.
Good friends and good fishing are fine, but good conversation is even better. Don't you think so?
Well, it's possible to run out of fish, I guess, but conversation goes on forever.
And something else that'll go on forever? Some of the exploits in Minnesota's fabulous sports history. We have about covered the field now, except for football.
And that's quite a chapter.
When did the University of Minnesota first begin playing football, Halsey?
Well, it was back in 1882. And the Gophers' first opponent was Hamline University in St. Paul. The Gophers played a good many of the smaller schools around these parts back in the 1800s. And you can date Minnesota's rise to the big time from the famous Little Brown Jug Battle of 1903. Michigan had left its water jug behind after the game. Oscar Munson, the lovable old Swede who used to be equipment manager, went to Doc Williams.
Mr. Williams?
Yes, Oscar?
It looks like Mr. Yost forgot his jug. What do you want me to do about it? Should I send it back to Michigan?
Well, I suppose we'll have to, Oscar. Say, now wait a minute. I'll tell you what you do. You write to Mr. Yost, and you tell him if he wants his water jug back, he'll have to win it in next year's game with Minnesota.
And so came to be the contest for the Little Brown Jug, to this day one of the highlights of every football season. And who can forget the great Bronco Nagurski, the immortal Bronc who played in every game for 3 years at Minnesota and turned in his greatest performance in the 1928 game against Wisconsin at Madison. And then, the golden era. Bernie Bierman, the Gray Eagle himself. Bernie stepped in to guide the fortunes of Minnesota in 1932. His 1933 season was good, no defeats, but four ties. And for three straight years, the Gophers were undefeated back there in the power-packed middle 30s. In 28 games, only one tie marred an otherwise perfect record. And the greatest team of them all, 1934. One game stood out, Minnesota versus Pittsburgh. This was the meeting of two football titans, greatest in the land. And newsmen and football greats came from all over the nation to see the game of the year. But the Minnesota fans were disappointed at halftime. The Gophers trailed 7-0. And now, something I've always wondered, I can ask this question of Bernie Bierman himself. Bernie, just what did you tell your boys there in the locker room at halftime?
Well, Halsey, our planned strategy had been to play a defensive game, playing for the breaks and wearing the Pittsburgh boys down. And rather forcefully, I tried to tell them that they've got to alter their plans a little bit and they have to get two touchdowns. Well, we had a group that year that had an awful lot of confidence in themselves, and they assured me definitely they would get the two touchdowns. And from that time on, it was purely an offensive show on our part.
And the rest is history. It worked. The Gophers, led by Sheldon Bisey and Stan Kostka and Julie Alphonse and Glenn Seidel, turned the tide in the second half. The Gophers won 13-7, and they went on to their first national championship. It was in 1936 that the great Gopher winning streak was broken at last, October 31st, at Evanston, Illinois, in a drenching rain. But that was the Gophers' only loss that season, and they were again proclaimed national champions. In 1938 and 39, Gopher fortunes fell. And then two more bright years nationally. 1940, and the Gophers were again undefeated. Again national champions. And the key game that year, will you ever forget it? The year that Bruce Smith and Minnesota turned back the mighty Tom Harmon in Michigan in a Drizzly Memorial Stadium, the famous 7-6 victory. You may remember Michigan led 6-0 when it happened.
They've switched, ladies and gentlemen. Bruce Smith and George Frank, with Smith moving from left half to right half. He takes a handoff through tackle. He eludes two Michigan tacklers. He's down. No, he's not down. He's all right, still going. And he's going. Holy cow, he's past the 50-yard line. the 40, the 30, the 20, the 10, and it's a touchdown.
And remember Joe Murnik, the boy with the educated toe? Murnik did it that afternoon, converted for the extra point, and Minnesota had scored its seventh consecutive Little Brown Jug victory. The Gophers won their fifth national title and their sixth conference championship under Bernie Bierman with another undefeated season in 1941. But it was touch and go in the Northwestern game that year. Bruce Smith went out of the game with an injured knee. The Gophers were trailing 7-2, and their prospects looked bleak that afternoon. And then Bernie Bierman sent word from the bench, use the talking play. Now that talking play, the Gophers had the ball, and they had run a play near the sideline, and as the referee was bringing the ball back to put it on those hash mark stripes, Bob Swigger, the Minnesota fullback, engaged a couple of Northwestern linemen in conversation, sort of kidding with them, and gave a cue to a couple of other Gophers. And while this was going on, the ball was put down at center. Gene Flick was the Gopher center, and before Northwestern could line up and get set, he passed the ball backward to Bud Higgins. And Higgins took that ball, and before the startled Northwestern players could rouse themselves, a couple of them just made token grabs for him. He streaked like a rabbit for the touchdown that won the game. And the game ended with an 8-7 victory for the Gophers. And ironically, Johnny Getchell, the same official who had upset Minnesota's fortunes back in 1936, refereed the 1941 game and ruled the talking play perfectly legal, which it was. And Minnesota fans have not given up hope, still dream of the day when there will be another golden era in Memorial Stadium.
Halsey, you must be out of gas by this time.
Yeah, I'm afraid I am. It's been a great day, though.
Oh, I'm glad you said that, Hall, because if you aren't out of gas, the boat is almost.
All right, that does it. Let's go home.
Say, I don't suppose you fellas remember with all the talking, but just thought you'd like to know, we got our limit.
Now, I ask you, can a Minnesotan ask for anything more? Good companions, good conversation, and a good catch of fish.
Sure. I can think of one thing more.
All right, Halsey, what is it? Maybe I shouldn't ask.
Some good Samaritan on shore to clean all those fish.
That did it. Turn her around, Cedric.
And when the dark spear of a pine stabs across the red face of the sun, and the evening shadows lengthen across the quieting waters, when the crazy call of the loon echoes, bouncing from shore to shore in the evening hush, when the fisherman returns home, tired, but able to say with feigned casualness, "Yep, got our limit, just lucky, I guess," that's living, the way we live in Minnesota. And the sportsman returns home, time to clean the gun, there are pheasant and duck and deer waiting, out among the corn stubble and the marshes, and the pine-scented trails. Big football games in the fall, with the smoky autumn haze in the air, the shrill of the whistle in the packed gym on crisp winter nights. The state basketball tournament. You bet we're going all the way this year. Opening fishing season. The air is raw and clean. Comes the first crack of the bat in the spring. The 4th of July doubleheader with the sultry heat of the day pressing down. That's living in Minnesota. And in between, we dream and we strive. Major League Baseball, yes, you'll see it played right here in Minnesota. Another golden era in Minnesota football. A new stadium. Resort vacations on beaches where the sun beats down. The tearing of the wind on the downhill run. Skiing time in the winter wonderland of Minnesota. This is the way we live and work and play. The way we will live here in our lakes and forests for the next 100 years. Enjoying the beauty of our state, yet guarding it. That is our heritage for the next century. here in Minnesota, the state of pleasure.